each scholar will have 10 to 15 minutes to present the, his views on the topic. And after both of them give their presentations, we're going to open up the floor for questions. Brother Muhammad will walk around with the microphone when the time is needed.
صلى على محمد وآل محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد.
Thank you for the introduction to the topic. The only correction I would make is the first scholar you have here is Sheikh Hamza, and the second scholar is more a student than a scholar. But I'm glad to be here to join in this discussion, and I think the intended format of this session was to be a participatory discussion. So I hope that all of you will take an active part with questions and also with your thoughts and comments. I don't have any particular detail that I want to give in the beginning, but I will make a few remarks. Inshallah, Sheikh Hamza will provide some completion and some insight to begin the discussion. The issue of how we can conceive of our identity as Muslims living in a society where religion is not considered to be a formative part or a worthy part of a person's identity is a very important question. It is considered by most people in society, and even many Muslims, to be backward and to be undesirable, to give too much importance to a religious identity. Many people view it very similar to giving focus to a person's ethnic or tribal identity as being the primary source of who they are. So if, for example, I were to say that, well, I am Chinese, or I am black, or I am white, or whatever other shade that could accurately describe any of us, that would be seen as something which is very negative for a person to use as a defining aspect of their identity, their loyalties, their affiliation. And in society as a whole, religion is very similar. If there is a society that defines itself, and I'm not speaking specifically of a state here, but for example, a state, that says we are a Muslim country, and therefore the head of our government, president, or the symbol of our society should be a Muslim, that is seen as something that is regressive, that is in need of enlightenment. And many Muslims will also have at least a question in their mind that isn't it better to live in a country like, for example, the United States, where religion is not, at least officially, a barrier to holding any office. And so that's a question that we as Muslims need to examine. I think that what we will, inshallah, be able to do in this session and for your own studies and for your own further reflection, contemplation afterwards, and inshallah with the benefit of the insight and guidance of Sheikh Hamza and participation of all of you, is to look at this on two different levels. One is the level of what is an Islamic ideal? What are we aspiring to? What are we praying for? What are we working towards? Does Islam give any recognition to boundaries, to borders, to different countries, laws that exist? Or are all of these things something that we want to do away with? What is our ideal? That's a normative discussion. But then there is another level, which is, what is our response to the world that we do live in. Still a normative level, but a more immediate level. If you want to differentiate the two different levels that we're speaking of or that we need to look at, one is a bit more proactive. What are we trying to accomplish or to change the labels and the assumptions of our world in order to accomplish? The other level is how do we respond to what is already present in our world? There might be certain things that as Muslims we don't give any intrinsic value to, but we still need to have a response that might involve two different levels and two different layers of action. And those two questions should not be confused with one another. Some of the confusion that many Muslims have on a theoretical and on a mental level, and some of the confusion that we see in Islamic organizations, especially here in the West, but perhaps even more broadly, is because these two different levels of concern are not differentiated, or not differentiated sufficiently. So that is what we need to be giving some thought to. Facile and very easy solutions are not always going to be meaningful and not always going to be sufficient in order to deal with the range of challenges that the identities that Muslims have and the identities that Muslims have imposed upon them will bring. There is a certain complexity, there is a certain nuance which we do need to recognize. The question of whether it would be better to live in a society that gave greater recognition to religious identity is not something that we can simply view very simplistically. If that identity were given greater respect, in some cases, for example, in our society, it may mean that Muslims may not be able to be as in-your-face about their religion. Just as in any Muslim society, non-Muslims are not as in-your-face about their religion. Certainly not as public as we are here. There would be pluses and there would be minuses to that state of affairs. And so we want to be able to develop some insight and some understanding of that complexity and that nuance. And then examine how we should configure our loyalties and our priorities, both on a proactive and on a reactive level. So that's, what I think is a good framework for us to proceed with the discussion. And if you would like, we can even maybe divide up towards the end of the session the topic to those two different levels of approach to the question of our identity as members of the Muslim Ummah and the relationship of that identity to our existing temporal identity.
Sayyid Suleiman, who always with his humility expresses learning from the Ahlul Bayt what you should not be taking at face value, and it's actually the other way around. I don't think I can consider myself a scholar. With regards to the subject, the topic that we have for this session, which is a very important topic, I think more important than a lot of us take it to be. For a lot of us, maybe it seems to be one of those topics that every now and then we hear about: Islamic identity, the Muslim Ummah, unity, how do we remove cultural barriers, and so on and so forth. God knows how many times I've heard that, and how many times we've heard discussions, and just it's just a talk that is cliche sometimes, and you get nowhere with it. I really don't believe that that is the nature of this topic. It's a very important, very practical discussion. But the only reason why I feel it has become a topic that is seen to be cliche and is seen to be a topic that is just something to spend some time, moments, maybe hours, discussing and really not having any practical outcome, is because our people, the Muslims, have not been able to understand the importance of this. If we are able to understand the importance of it, we would all together be striving to create that Muslim Ummah. Let me hopefully briefly explain what I mean by that. When the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam started his mission in Mecca as a single soul that has received revelation, along with a true companion, Ali ibn Abi Talib salamullah alayh, and his wife Khadija salamullah alayha, three individuals under the sun that believe in this, was able to gradually bring individuals in that very tribal society of complete disbelievers in the religion of Islam. From different tribes and different races, he was able to bring them into Islam, whether it's Salman al-Farsi, who was not Arab, the different Arab tribes, some of those tribes being ones that were looked down upon, were coming from tribes from Africa, like Bilal al-Habashi. The Holy Prophet brings all of these individuals together, moves to Medina, again, unites those believers over there, and is able to create a movement that impacted the entire globe at that time, and we are seeing the result of it today. It's the continuation of that. A lot of times we don't see that connection, right? One of the very important elements in the Holy Prophet's movement in creating this momentum in the world was the ability to create one ummah of all these different people from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different tribes. If we want to reach the state which the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam wanted us to have, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to have, the Imam of our time is waiting not in a form and in a way where he is not actively involved with this, but rather in a way where we are not able to see his input in this whole thing. It is clear to me, at least. I haven't spoken and discussed this matter with Sayyid Sulaiman before, but the Imam of our time is very active today in moving this movement forward, but in a way where we are not able to see him and have that connection with him. Anyhow, the way that the Holy Prophet wanted us to be, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to be, the Imam of our time is trying to help us in a way where we're not seeing him and pushing this movement until it reaches a stage where the Muslims actually have that identity. If we want to reach that, we need to create or recreate that ummah that the Holy Prophet created. Without that, we're not going to be able to succeed. Working off of what Sayyid Sulaiman mentioned, I will discuss something with regards to the proactive approach towards this identity and the ummah. And that is, what the Holy Prophet did in his proactive approach to create that ummah with an identity, he did two things. One, which is something that in the intro of this topic is mentioned, sort of. He removed superficial identities that people had, like the tribal identity that a person had at that time. Of course, I don't want to say he completely removed it. No, he didn't completely remove that. He don't completely remove that. But that was given a key and fundamental role in giving the identity of a person. It was reduced to what the Holy Quran says, لِيَتَعَارَفُ. I'm from this tribe, I'm from this country, I'm from that part of the world. But it doesn't define who I am. It's just about, you know, in order for us to be able to differentiate and understand where, what part of the world we are, and so on and so forth. It's not something that defines you and separates us from one another. He reduced it. So there are certain things that people considered important in their identity that the Holy Prophet had to reduce, sometimes maybe eliminate. But then there was something else, and that was the creation of an identity. You can't just remove and reduce those without giving something else as a replacement that creates your identity. I think what I would like to see, and I would like to discuss, and I think it's very important if we want to move on that path and embark on this journey to create, do our share to create that Muslim ummah with this identity. We have to figure those two ideas out. What is it that we need to reduce? To what extent do we need to reduce some of those defining factors in our identities? And what is it that we need to strengthen in ourselves, in our communities, collectively, to be able to create that identity? These are two areas that I think in that proactive approach we need to address, inshallah.
Now it's time for you guys to participate and ask questions, and inshallah those questions will be answered, and then hopefully we'll have a vibrant discussion. If you have a question, raise your hand, and other comrades will come around.
Salam, brother. My question is, do we need to lose our, let's say, I'm an Arab, I'm Lebanese. I live in the United States, I have lived here for many, many years, so I have spent most of my life in the United States. But if I understand what you're trying to say, we have to give up our ethnic identity, at least if not for my generation, for my generation, and try to give them an Islamic identity. So the Lebanese identity, the Arab identity needs to take a step back, and we need to bring forward a new identity, which is an Islamic identity. Is this what we're calling for here?
I would like to, I don't know if Sayyid agrees with this, but I don't like it to be a form of a Q&A. Okay, I think the idea that I got from the description of this program is that it's supposed to be a discussion. Okay. And so, I don't know, I ask you guys, are we trying to say that we have to, what is the meaning of an Islamic identity? Could somebody define that for me, please? What is an Islamic identity? And also, do we need to remove which part of that identity, the other ethnic identity? Is it the Lebanese part? Is it the Arab part? What about the American part? Okay. How does this
work? I can just add one additional question. I want to take your question, which is a valid point of discussion, I think, and in light of Sheikh Hamza's question. We can take one concrete example. This doesn't need to limit our discussion, but it's something which many of us may have experienced. Among all of the masjids, specifically masjids associated with the school of Ahlul Bayt, throughout the United States, how many are there that you know of that have been effectively able to transcend limitations of language, preference for spicy or non-spicy food, or whatever else there is, poetry, and Lafniya, and Dalhe, and Dahi, whatever. Create a space that everyone feels welcome. If you take English, then there are, there was a time when I was growing up when people, the conventional wisdom was that all of these regional languages, Arabic and Persian and Urdu, they're gonna come to an end. And by the time I would grow up, my generation would grow up, everything would be in English. Little did we know that there would be refugees coming in, and many people now would see that there's a resurgence of Arabic or Urdu or perhaps Persian that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago when I was a child. There is that need. There is a need for English. So we can look at it, not limited to this, but in the context of our centers. Is it possible? Is it desirable to put some of those identities on the back burner and alienate people then who can only really participate linguistically or for other reasons in the context of a particular identity? Is there a means to combine different identities or to keep them separate and yet still have a larger meeting? We have different models in our centers. Some are limited to one language group, one ethnic group. Sometimes we have some centers that try to bring everyone together, and generally English is the unifying language, and that does therefore leave out some people. We have other centers that try to do, say, three or four lectures at once. We have an English lecture, we have an Arabic, we have a Persian, we have an Urdu maybe. So what are the plus points, the minus points of these different attempts? Is there something that we can recommend for our own future and for the future of our centers? I think that relates to your question, relates also to the question of Sheikh Hamza. I don't mean to limit the discussion, but this is one concrete example that we can think about as well.
Definitely, Kobe, I'd like to correct my previous statement. As the Sheikh said, let this be an interactive discussion. Say your opinions, whether they're in the form of a Q&A or any other form that you wish or you feel relevant. Just raise your hand and Brother Muhammad will begin.
Now let me take the discussion for one more step. Let's take a look at case studies of communities who have existed in the United States for a
very long time. That would be a good starting point. We have had communities, Muslim communities, with major infusion of immigrants throughout the years, which if it didn't exist, probably those communities would have established a more defined culture, new culture. But the fact that there is a major infusion of immigrants, it's helping not to create that new culture that eventually will get there, but it hasn't gotten there. And what we're talking about is how we're going to look like. In other words, the question should be, how are we going to look at as Muslims in the next 10 years, in the next 20 years? If we simplify that question, then everyone who lives here will understand. How are we going to look like in 20 years? How our kids are going to raise their kids? This is what we're looking for. This is the question we're trying to ask now. Hopefully we could find an answer to see how we're going to look like in 20 or in 40 years.
I surely I love when I travel throughout the country and I visit a Pakistani mosque or a mosque or whatever and I get the food and it's nice and I share, you know, we share different rites and customs. But when it comes, it feels like culture, from my perspective, sometimes hinders people from actually seeing the, or if I can use this term, culture for food in a sense. So I think what the brother is trying to say is that, is there an Islamic idea or,
I believe in a historical example, the first thing that comes to my mind is that figures, Islamic historical figures such as Sayyid ibn Khaldun, would go around the Islamic world and he'd travel all around and say, I went from place to place and felt as if I was at home throughout. In this day and age, we can't really say that, unfortunately, because right now we don't have the privilege of having an Islamic empire or having political law, political legal factors that are kind of encompassing throughout an Islamic ummah, per se. So now the real question is, how do we follow that same route where we could also say, now we know we're all Muslims and we're similar, but at the same time in this new day and age, see that we have all these cultural differences, and these cultural differences drive to a large degree our identity, and sometimes more so than our religious identity. And I mean, really, could we go back to days where Ibn Khaldun said, I can go around anywhere and say, because I'm a Muslim, that's all I am. I'm not so sure if you do that anymore because of the political differences. And I mean, really, just the regional differences, the fact that now we have an ummah across an ocean, and we don't have an Islamic world anymore to the same degree.
I think we've heard some important points. One especially important point that several of you have raised is the idea that culture is not something that we should view as being in tension with our religious identity. And we shouldn't say culture versus religion. And if we think of culture as something like family, our family is certainly part of who we are. It is certainly our origin and a very important support network and safety network, and something that can serve as a safety net. Spiritually and religiously, and not just economically and materially, culture can play that same role. The question, the earlier question that we had, is to what extent can we form our cultural identities so as to strengthen our religious identity and our sense of belonging to a Muslim ummah? A few concrete examples in addition to, how would we like to organize a center? And if we have a large immigrant population, which is still continuing, a refugee population, how do we want to integrate them within our community practice? To what extent do we want to say, you're in our country now, and you will learn English, or you will sort of be at the back of the hall? And to what extent can we try to make room for various cultural expressions? And does that naturally mean that then there will be sort of borders which are difficult to permeate? Other examples that I want to also introduce and which are related to that. Should we encourage our children? I was born in the United States. My children will be then the third generation in America. Many of us will be in a somewhat similar situation. Should we encourage them to learn their parents' or their grandparents' language? Right? Now, if your language is Arabic, you might want to learn Quranic Arabic for religious reasons, but should you also pass on some of the more cultural expressions, the dialect of your family? For a second generation, it might make sense. They have immediate family, uncles, aunts, cousins. But the third generation doesn't have that immediate culture, that immediate cultural affinity. So passing on language. Citizenship. Should we try to encourage Muslims to maintain a link of social or political participation or even citizenship in their former country, in their former lands? Does that compromise our ability to form a vibrant cultural identity for Muslims that brings Muslims together in America? Or can it actually assist in creating that cultural identity in America? And what we're looking for here, again, as I've seen, is not universal answers. That we need to do this or we need to just do that. But we're looking for specific examples of what has been ineffective, for example, and what we need to avoid in our communities and in our centers. Or what has potentially been effective and how these identities, which exist, and which from what I'm hearing from many of you, and I would agree, should exist, how can they serve to strengthen our identity with the Muslim Ummah?
So kind of going along with something Sayyid said earlier, I think that culture is actually really helpful to people like immigrants and just people like making that come to the country. And as much as I love diversity, sometimes it's good to have like a masjid that might be all in Arabic or one that's all in Urdu or something, because we don't want people to be uncomfortable. Like, culture is directly correlated with comfort. And if you're uncomfortable in a situation and like maybe you don't understand the language of the masjid, that's just furthering you from Islam, making you uncomfortable with the community, and that's not going to help anybody. So as much as I do love diversity, like I said, sometimes it's like necessary to have that.
We are, as immigrants from different countries, mashallah, there's many, many countries they come. And from any country, if they come from any country, usually they are very few, not very many. What I think, if we give the first priority for the religion, if anybody ask me, I say I'm Muslim. But what I am culturally, I'm from this country. Okay? If they ask me, from where are you? I say, okay, I'm from Iraq. Okay, what part of Iraq? Okay, doesn't matter. If I say Baghdad. But originally, the first thing I will say, I'm Muslim. I don't need to destroy my country or my citizenship or all these things, or I'm Indian or I'm Pakistani. These are good things. Because see, now here in the United States, one day they have celebration, the Irish people, all of them American. All of them, let me say, most of them, if it's not all of them, they are American. They are 5-6 generations down, but they say we are Irish. They go and they celebrate and they talk about their culture. Same thing with the many, many other celebrations. The other people with Spanish language, they say from Mexico. They have celebration for Mexico. For this reason, what I think, since especially in Chicago, we come say, and say, okay, we have mosque for Iraq, mosque for Lebanese, mosque for... We don't have so many people. For this reason, what's supposed to be, we are this mosque for Muslims. Muslim, Nasir. In this case, we accumulate all the people there, we cooperate and this, but that doesn't mean we cancel our religion. Same thing with the Muslim comes. The Quran is Arabic, you have to pray in Arabic. But God doesn't say you should forget all your origin language like Persian or the Hindu or the other language, cancel it. No, you need to learn Arabic, you need to pray in Arabic, but still you could keep your culture. وَخَلَقْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً مُخْتَلِفَ لِتَعَارَفُوا بَيْنَكُمْ. Doesn't say everybody should change. Thank you.
Just one thing I want to make. I agree, culture is important, but I think sometimes by trying to preserve culture, it has come into the practice of a religion, and people are starting to confuse cultural traditions with what the religion actually asks for. So I think we need to make sure that we know what is religion and what is culture, and not say, this is part of the religion where it's actually just part of culture. So I think that's one thing we need to make certain of, whether we agree with keeping the culture or being more into a melting pot, either one, but make sure that we know what our religion is and what our culture is and differentiate between the two.
Brother, I would encourage everyone to use the microphone because we don't hear.
Yeah, please.
Okay, the only question that comes to mind is, because I know the scholars that we have here, like Sayyid Suleiman, you mentioned that you were, you know, it's your second generation American, and I know Sheikh Hamza, you know, you have, your mother, I think, is American, and your father's side is Iranian, so what I would like to hear from the scholars, like what comes to your mind when you have gone through, you know, all these studies of these Islam and Hausa, like what comes to your mind, and I'm sure you guys are married and have kids, So maybe you can let us know what, I'm just curious to hear what you have to say. Oh,
I still have a lot of questions from you guys. I have some answers. I'm trying to come to an understanding. Can before, because I'm comparing this discussion in this room here, this conference here, to some of the similar discussions that we've had with brothers and sisters in other conferences or camps. I'm seeing some differences. And I'm trying to analyze this for myself. And one of the questions that's going to help me understand this is, by show of hands, can we see how many do we have in this room here from Dearborn, Michigan?
Sallu ala Muhammad.
How many Lebanese do we have in this
crowd?
Because I have seen this issue, and we're talking about coming together and forming a Muslim ummah. All right. Sometimes we hear this idea, sometimes people come out and they're very harsh against culture, and I can understand where some of the sisters were talking about that culture and that it's good to see that and so on and so forth. But in Dearborn, Michigan, how many non-Arabs and Lebanese do you have that are able to come into the centers in the Islamic Center of America or in Darul Hikmah or in some of the other centers that you have and feel like this is a home of mine as well, as a Muslim, as a Shia, okay, as a follower of the Ahlul Bayt? Do we have them? Do we have, is there any outreach in Dearborn, Michigan? Do we have, not just Dearborn, but I'm mentioning this because I want to create that question, if it's not there. Are we trying to say, and I think some of the examples that Sayyid Suleiman is bringing forth is for this reason. We're trying to here discuss what the solution to a problem that does exist is going to be. I'm trying to see if we're all on the same page about there being a problem in the first place. Okay. And then looking towards trying to find a solution. Is the status quo something we need to keep, or does it need to change? Then, if we come to the conclusion that it needs to change, we're going to have to figure out how that's going to be changing. One of the questions I've always had, or a lot of times when visiting Dearborn, Michigan, is with such a large Muslim and Shia population over there, why isn't there any effort, or at least I have, tell me if there is, I haven't been informed that there is, any effort to bring anybody else and make them part of this as well. Bring others into Islam, welcome them into Islam from different ethnic backgrounds, be it the African Americans in downtown Detroit, which is pretty close by, the other Americans, and of course we had that question with regards to other ethnicities in and outside of Dearborn, Michigan, that would come over there. Do they feel the same? And do we feel that we need to continue with this? Does there need to be a change in this, or does there not to be? brother. People from Durban can maybe comment about that.
Just one comment I have, you know, maybe we should first define what do you mean by culture. You know, I understand what we mean by religion. I understand the religion, what does it have, but if you can define what culture means. For example, when we say the American culture, okay, there are a lot of things in the American cultures that maybe we don't agree with in terms from an Islamic point of view. You know, like the main message here, I think it's important to say, it's we all should strive for the message. There is a message that we all should strive for to achieve. How do we achieve it? I don't see any issue, you know, with like bringing, for example, someone from Lebanese background or someone from Iranian background or someone from Pakistani background or American background, as long as they have the same message. Okay, it's important, you know, for people that have different messages to start opening a communication link to try and understand what are the differences between these messages. I'm afraid that when we say like we need to melt into the American culture, that we are not giving the proper message to the community. Because we need to make sure that our people who are following Islam and Itna Sharia, that they need to understand exactly what do we mean by melting into the American culture. Because I'm so afraid to think that my kids will be melting into the American culture. When I see, for example, in certain areas, there are certain things that they believe in and Islam totally disagree on. You know, so if you can define better, or if we can help the audience today, you know, exactly, instead of saying like, for example, these centers are not opening to the others, or instead of saying, like, for example, in Dearborn, they don't have a very good interaction with the others. You know, I would say probably let's define how can we interact with others properly. Because it might be in one way offensive. And we may be also making some accusations that probably the leaders in this mosque are really, they either don't see it, or they probably need help, you know, with making them see how can we open to the others.
Maybe we have the sister in the back, the brother.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone.
Assalamu.
I'm from Dearborn, Michigan, and I want to speak on behalf of maybe like the Islamic Center of America. And I think, you know, the brother just touched on something at the end where you don't hear a lot of it. I know in Dearborn, alhamdulillah, I think we're blessed because there's so many masjids in the area. That's one thing. You see masjids all across Dearborn. I think there are, if last time I checked, there were 7 masjids. And they're all different, you know, I mean, most of them are Shia. I think there's only 1 Sunni masjid in Dearborn, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, please, but I think a lot of people don't know what's going on. Like at the Islamic Center of America, over 5 times a week, they have non-Muslims coming, so that's like some outreach that they do. But I think the other type of outreach that we don't see is with the English-speaking programs that they have. That brings in a lot more people than like the normal, like that you would see normally like during Friday prayer. So that's just something I wanted to tell you, and you guys made me nervous.
Before we move on to the other side,
I think the Dearborners were offended, and they're getting a bit energetic. It's good. That'll bring some, yeah.
I did because I see it. We do so much, you know?
But you're in Dearborn, sister. No, but you're in Dearborn, sister. You're part of that group, okay, that is the majority in Dearborn, Michigan, all right? A lot of Dearborners, I'm not generalizing, but I've got this, I travel a lot, okay? I travel a lot, and I've visited different communities in the United States, in Canada, in many countries, in Europe, in Australia, okay? And there are two very similar places on this planet. One is Dearborn, Michigan. The other one is Sydney, Australia. Okay. Okay, yeah, but...
...and Iraqi, that's the majority. Like 90% of the Arabs that you're going to see in that area are Lebanese and Iraqi. So
yeah, but we're not addressing Dearborn, Michigan here. We are addressing the United States of America and Canada, for God's sake. This is the... Muslim group of USA and Canada, not Muslim group of Dearborn, Michigan. Now, when you look at the bigger picture, a lot of times when people are visiting, like let's go back to Dearborn, Michigan. How many of you in Dearborn, Michigan has visited the ZWA community? Out of all the hands that we have, huh? How many times have you visited the ZWA community? Because you guys are, you know, how many times? Twice. How old are you, sister? Okay. That's a bad question to ask, sister. All right. I get it. But the idea is twice, okay? Now, again, let's not do this personal, right, at all. In many other cities, okay, the masajid that exist, being ethnically oriented, okay, which is for the most part most of the communities that we come across, they don't have such a large community of the same ethnic background, so densely populating a particular city, that they don't really have to ask this question because they feel at home whichever masjid they go to in Dearborn, Michigan. It's all the same thing. But in most other communities, it's not like that. You go to one center, okay, this is home. You go to the other center, people look at you weird. And people who are not from Dearborn, Michigan, they come into Dearborn, Michigan, they're not from that ethnic background, they feel like, okay, there's Shia, great, there's good food there, they can tell you that. But, sometimes they may feel left out, and I do know a lot of people that do feel that. Okay. So the question is this good? Is this not good? Do we need to change this? How do we change this?
But brother, by just one thing, do we change by mouthing, or do we change by opening to the others? You know, that's the main point here. I mean, it's important to...
Melting, see... I don't think, at least in our discussion, see, sometimes we have this discussion and say, okay, should we melt in the American culture or should we not? The relationship of a Muslim with the American culture, how should that be? Can we define that?
Exactly.
That's one discussion. Another discussion is, okay, we are Muslims living in America. Some of us have American backgrounds. Some of us have Middle Eastern backgrounds. Some of us have Eastern backgrounds that are not Middle Eastern, and so on and so forth. Okay, which should our relationship be with the larger ummah and with ourselves? I don't think we're trying to address that question as should we melt in the American culture. I don't believe in melting in the American culture. I believe that the American culture is another culture that can develop Islam within the American culture, and there can be a Muslim-American culture, right, for those who come from that background, and of course various subcultures that you have within American culture. I believe you can have an Islamic version of every single one of those. But do we need to become that? Not necessarily. But do we need to become something that brings us all together? I believe so. What is that thing that we need to become to bring everybody together? So as the brother said, when Ibn Khaldun goes around and he says, I feel at home, at least when we go to our own Shia centers, we don't feel alien. Okay, we don't feel that this is not my place. And speaking as the child of an American convert, I can tell you this, that the American converts don't feel at home in pretty much any of the centers. Okay. People from Maryland can, I know there are some people in the crowd from IEC, used to be a bit more multicultural. Now non-Iranians, I think, in general, feel a bit alienated in that community over there. But forget about the recent or the last maybe 10, God knows how many years that this has moved in this direction. There was a time when a lot of the African-American, white-American, Hispanic-American, all these backgrounds that are not Middle Eastern that came into Islam used to come and feel at home to a certain extent, at least, in some of those centers. And it's not the same. Okay. This is, I think, what at least I am trying to get us to come to a common understanding on.
As far as, I'm going to bounce off of the brother's comments about melting in and what you just said. As far as the what I'm sensing is that there's, especially with the first generation and even maybe into the trickles into the second generation immigrants in America, there's a big fear of losing your religion or losing your culture, and that fear of melting and you losing your children to that. And I'm a first generation American. I was born overseas and I immigrated here with my mom and dad. And I can tell you my family, my parents, had a very big fear of losing their kids to this culture and losing their kids, losing their religion in America. And because of that, though, they had this fear of the unknown, and so they kind of went the other way. And I feel like that fear could, disable us in a way where we're making our kids grow up in this bubble, and we're not teaching them how to interact properly with the greater society, with their culture, because they are being raised in this culture, whether or not the parents like it or not, we're living in America. And so I think as far as a solution-focused approach to balancing that identity, because for me that was a humongous thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but especially for first, second, and even third generation immigrants, identity and figuring out your identity as far as ethnically, your home country, American identity, and Islam is a very, very scary and hard struggle. And so as far as a solution-focused approach, I think it would be helpful for parents and us as we grow up and become parents too, the younger generation, is to not fear that unknown and try to integrate the differences and work together through that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I mentioned earlier, I agree with everybody saying my culture is important. But I wanted to posit the question, whose culture is most important? Your children, our children, inshallah, like, are not necessarily going to be marrying the same culture that you grew up in or that I grew up in. And so when we're going to be facing, as a community, a lot of intermarriage between cultures, whether we like it or not. And we have to come to, I think, a conclusion, or at least a comfort level with these mixed cultures. And have a real conversation about the superiority complex we have in our communities that, stems a lot, I think, from culture. That's how I go.
What I wanted to say is, I've been in this country in 1978. And as I came here, it was the beginning of forming the Islamic Revolution. Alhamdulillah, that happened. And I have gone through Iranian gatherings. Then brother Pakistani gatherings, I have been involved and I have very good experience with this. First of all, I think in any of our centers, the common language we should speak is English. We came here, the common language who everybody understands is English. I go to many of these massages. They have mixed programs. The program starts with English. There are some American, some Arab, a few Persian, so on and so forth. But as soon as this program ends and the new session starts with new language, these people go. What we see when we go to Mecca, different type of the people from all of the world come to one center. Here we came, I think the best thing we can emphasize on is the English language. That is how we can bring everybody in. If we have started that from the beginning, believe me, the result we see right now here, maybe many, many Americans, instead of just seeing where the most of the Shia community comes from. Thank you very much.
There was actually another topic that I was hoping that we would be able to work into and prepared to bring in. I don't know how much time we have now. So if we get a chance, maybe I'll introduce that question. But I think that we've had a nice range of views with regard to the question of what should we look at as a way of responding to cultural diversity, at the very least in terms of ethnicity and in terms of language. Several of you, and Sheikh Hamza also brought the example of different communities, the IEC community in Maryland. One thing that is probably observable in many different cities, at least across the United States if you travel, you'll notice that communities start out... Are we okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Communities start out somewhat small, and so they have a need to build bridges. Inertia naturally results in many communities slowly separating as the population increases. And so as the number of Muslims, for example, in a city increases, the center that used to incorporate Sunni and Shia and different schools of thought within Sunni Islam, for example, might be associated with one school of thought. Now it's a Sunni masjid, and eventually this is the Salafi masjid, and this is the other masjid, so on and so forth. Within the Shia community as well, we've seen something similar. And what we want to examine is how we can proactively and also reactively respond to that reality. I want to give one example, a concrete example from the time of the Prophet, just to give us something to think about. I'm not going to draw any categorical conclusions from it, but I think it's something which can be instructive. When the immigrants came from Mecca to Medina, as you're all familiar, one of the things the Prophet did is he created a relationship known in Islamic history as Mu'akhat, a fraternity between the Muhajirin and between the Ansar. And so every Muhajir was paired with an Ansari. What did it mean to be a brother? Well, if you look at history, they actually thought that they had to fully integrate them within their lives. If they had property, give half or a part of their property to their brother. In some cases, this doesn't look good to our modern sensibilities, but it's part of history. If there was an Ansari who had, say, two wives, and there was a Muhajir who was not married, then that person would try to see if he could marry the Muhajir by offering to divorce one of his wives. So that was something which in a tribal culture, in a society, division of property, the helping to establish a family, proposing to someone, bringing that together as you would deal with a relative, as you would deal with a brother or sister, that was part of the mu'akhah. In some cases, the Prophet said, no, this is not the way to do it. Some of these examples that I mentioned, the Prophet actually guided people to do things in a different way. But when people were told, this is your brother, and you are to treat them as your brother, they began to respond as they were used to doing in their tribal society even before Islam. They took it very seriously. What did eventually come up as the result of the fraternity? Many of the relationships remained. But over time, Islam undid some of the laws that had come in that fraternity. One of which was inheritance. So it used to be the case that a muhajir would inherit from an Ansari who had been made his brother, and vice versa. And that was abrogated. There was a recognition that was instituted in Islamic law and in Sharia that the natural state of affairs is for that tribal identity and that family identity to take precedence. And so there was a step taken by the Prophet to integrate the two communities, but not to go beyond the limit of what society could naturally and organically take. Not to try to artificially say that, all right, we're going to pretend that you're not Ansari and you don't have a different accent of Arabic and a different family background and some different cultural institutions. Pretend that now you and the Muhajirin from Quraysh and from other tribes are all one. There was a step taken to undo tribalism, and then the Prophet, in some sense, legislated a retreat from that symbolic step in order to legislate a law that would have continuity. And in our society in America, we have a somewhat similar process. There is a natural state that the mixing of different identities will produce and has produced. And we see it in many different cities, somewhat in Chicago, more so in other cities, where as populations increase, there is a self-selection and a separation of people into different categories. That's something similar that happened at the early history of Islam as well. What we need are means of understanding how we can recreate the response that the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, they adopted in the face of similar types of natural, social, and historical processes. So one example is that of the mu'akhah. It's not just about bringing people together, but how the Prophet brought people together, and then also how the Prophet recognized that there is a natural process of separation and how that is to be managed. After the Prophet left this world, there were numerous times when the different communities in Medina were very close to coming to blows, or actually did come to blows. And in several cases, those tensions were diffused by Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, where he said to his cousin Fadl ibn Abbas, who was a poet of Bani Hashim, when there were tensions between the Muhajirin and the Ansar, for example, Imam Ali told Fadl ibn Abbas, his cousin, that go and you compose poetry on behalf of the Ansar. Don't make them defend themselves. And so when the most prestigious poet of Quraysh is defending the Ansar, that naturally means that the Ansar don't feel that they have the need to defend themselves against their opponents or their adversaries from other communities, the Quraysh or others. That's another example that we have of how Islam recognized a certain natural process, but very dynamically and very wisely used certain means, somewhat symbolically, and sometimes legislated in law, but in many cases not, in order to undo the harmful effects of that separation. But the interesting challenge for us is certainly to utilize the fact that in some cities, so many people identify with one background. And no matter what we do, in many of those cases, people who have a certain ethnic or a certain linguistic background, if we de-emphasize it beyond a certain limit, many of those people will not replace it with an Islamic identity. They might adopt a secular or a non-Islamic identity. If we can recognize the natural historical processes and try to fine-tune a response that can take the edges off the separation and the differences that will result, and the self-segregation that we see and that some of us are complaining about, what we potentially can do is strengthen an Islamic identity and even benefit from those members of that ethnic community or that linguistic community who don't have a strong Islamic identity, but have enough of a familial identity or a cultural identity to still be of use to those with a stronger Islamic identity in social and in religious and in political terms. That's an aspect of the Sira which I think is very dynamic and which I think is understudied. So I wanted to give a few examples of that, and then inshallah, if Sheikh Hamza, if you would like to add some insights. Eventually, if we have time before the end, I wanted to just introduce another discussion of class.
How much time do we have?
4:18,
so
is it 4:43? I was seeing some hands up as well. I don't know if there's going to be a wrap up at the end of this or not. I think I'll say this, and for me, I think it'll be, unless somebody has something specific to ask myself, which I hope people don't, at least in the session, will be, I think, maybe my last comments that we can hear from others. I feel, as I said in the beginning of the intro as well, that it is important for us to think about our status quo. My observation is that there's a gap between where we are right now and what the ideals of Islam guide us towards. Where we are and what we need to be, there's a somewhat of a gap. Some may call it a huge gap, some may say it's a smaller gap. Nevertheless, there's a gap. And we need to actively think about and take steps towards lessening that gap and moving towards the ideals. That is the my major emphasis on this. I don't think that this is something that can be wrapped up in one session of such discussions. And I don't think it's something that you can have a lecturer come and give a lecture and then think that that is going to make it happen, all right? I think, and this is why I felt this was necessary, I think it is a discussion that the community as a whole needs to be involved with, feel the need for, think about solutions, and then gradually start moving towards the solutions. If we don't think we need to do that, we're never gonna move in that direction. So, the most important thing that I wanted to get out of this is to stress on the idea and to clarify the question that this is an issue that we are dealing with and we do need to take steps in that direction. Two areas that I feel I need to comment on very briefly just to at least give a direction on some of the questions that were raised, some of them I myself raised. I feel we need to have or direct our thoughts towards is with regards to culture, ethnicity, our backgrounds. Something that is, you know, some people said we need to, you know, it's important to keep that culture, we'll stress on that. I've been in gatherings where people have been very much against culture in this gathering. Either they weren't present or after the comments that were made, they didn't feel that they were able to make those comments against culture. But we do have that in our larger community. We have some of the second, third generation that are very much fed up with what they feel of the immigrant culture. They just don't want to have anything to do with it. And I think we have to kind of balance that out. It's not like we need to, and this is the direction I think we need to, I'm trying to put forth. Culture is not something that we're going to do without, and we're going to create one unified culture without any subcultures. Okay, and therefore I say, you know, this idea, some people say, and I don't even know what they mean by it, of course, that, you know, forget about culture, I'm just Muslim. I don't know what that actually means. I don't think you can define that, because naturally you will have a culture. You may remove, let's say if somebody's coming from a Pakistani background, you may remove the Pakistani part of it, but you're not going to remove the American part of it. Okay? You may remove the Lebanese part of it, but you're not going to remove, there's something about the way you behave. There's a difference between the way you dress, the way you speak, the way you behave on a regular basis, and someone that lives in a different part of the, in another part of the world. Okay? And that's called your culture. You're going to have that. And the idea isn't to remove that. The idea isn't to remove, as I said, in many instances, the Holy Prophet reduced the importance of it. This is what I'm trying to focus on. Sometimes there's so much emphasis on that ethnic background, the cultural background, that maybe some people realize it, some people don't. We are having this issue with ourselves that we are giving too much importance to the cultural background. Okay. I'll start with the Iranian background because I'm half Iranian as well. I can attack that first. All right. From the Iranian background, and there may be some people, brothers in the audience, that would disagree with me, but because I come from a mixed background, I kind of see both, right? So I feel the alienation that non-Iranians would feel in an Iranian gathering. And sometimes comments that are made, I don't want to get into those comments, about other backgrounds from that Middle Eastern or that region in the world, the East, comments that are made about the countries, and I'm not going to name countries, or about other ethnicities, again, I'm not going to name them, but I do hear this. There is this idea that this culture, this ethnic background has some superiority. Moving on to the Lebanese, with all due respect to the Iranian and the Lebanese. Again, this is not to in any way offend anybody. This is to correct all of us. I need to correct myself, everybody. I went with a Lebanese hamla to Hajj. Okay. And some of the brothers on the hamla, every step of the way, ihna lebnaniyin this, ihna lebnaniyin that. Okay, calm down, bro. Take it easy. I know, when Sid Hassan's name comes, you go crazy, yeah. You need to be proud of that figure. It's great. Okay. And I can turn around and say, okay, he takes pride in someone who's in the Islamic Republic of Iran. I can start taking pride in that. That's not, it's not about that, okay? It's good to not give in to the pride of a culture that you're living in a way where you feel inferior to that. That's good. Which, of course, sometimes I don't see that. Like, when it comes to the Iranian ethnic background. Towards people from that region, it's easy to say, oh, we're superior. When it comes to the Western or the American culture, there's less people that feel that pride against the Western culture. Okay. It's good to have that against maybe some type of influence like that. But the idea is this. That pride in that background, that ethnicity, language, culture, should not separate us. Okay. This is what becomes problematic. If I, and I remember, I just remembered that Hamla had some other ethnicities within it as a minority. And in Mina, those who've been in Hajj, you know how tiring it gets in Mina. That's one of the last stages of the Amal of Hajj. They've been to Arafat, they're tired, they've been to Mash'ad, now in Mina, they've gone in. Stoned the shayateen, and then now you have these tents, and people are lying in these tents like sardines. There's not really too much space. Okay. And then this is where that ethnic emphasis can come into the mix and create problems, and it shouldn't be like that. There were fights over this spot being mine or yours. Between two different ethnic backgrounds. This is what should not be seen. This is what the Holy Prophet fought against. It's not wrong to be Iranian. If you're Iranian, it's fine. Lebanese, Pakistani, Indian, Khoja, you name it. Yeah, I have this background. Okay. But does it give me the permission to look down upon somebody else because of either the color of their skin or the language they speak or the culture they have? This is where it becomes problematic. When you give it too much importance, that too much is where it separates me and doesn't allow me to feel as a brother or a sister to this person. I feel like I deserve more, or somebody from my background deserves this spot, and that other person from that other background doesn't deserve it. This is where it becomes problematic. And with regards to, so that's those are some of the things that we need to reduce, okay, the importance, not eliminate. There may be certain elements that we may need to eliminate as well in our identity, but those are some of the things that we need to reduce the importance of. It's there, it will remain. We've got to reduce the importance of them. With regards to what needs to increase in our identity, or we need to focus on, which we call it the Islamic identity. What is the Islamic identity? I encourage people to think about this. A lot of times people just come, they just want answers. Like, first of all, I'm not some alama that has answers for everything you ask, okay? Number one. Secondly, even if I have an answer, why don't you take some time out, think, all right? Why do you have to just hear an answer? Sometimes, some people, I can't generalize. It's good, I want to encourage people to think about this. What is an Islamic identity? What do we exactly mean by that? Putting up banners, chanting slogans, what is an Islamic identity? I think, I personally believe that Islamic identity that we need to work on as individuals and as communities, that was something that the Holy Prophet was able to bring everybody on, is something that transcends the material realm. It is the focus on Tawheed, the focus on the beliefs, the focus on belief in God and doing everything for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and that being the criteria for why we do things and why we don't do things in our lives. If that becomes something that is strong in us, then we're able to remove a lot of these differences and come together better. Because before Sayyid Suleiman introduces his next issue or question that he said he wants to put forth, I want to say this. Our differences are not limited to ethnic differences. The brother mentioned something very well, very good. I'm from Iraq, for example. And he asks, okay, so from what city? you have some differences in the cities at all. Or if it's from Iran, the city is from Iran. And you have people from Yazd that are closer together, or people from Shiraz that are closer together, and so on and so forth. And from Lebanon, yeah, if you're from the south, or from, you're from Baalbek, it makes a huge difference. Okay. And then when you're from the south, which village are you from? This makes a difference. Okay. And further and further, even in families, okay, we have all those differences that we need to try to remove the obstacles of coming together and forming that ummah, and that element that I need, I think, is one of the key elements, maybe the most important, that is going to help us come together, is that iman, the faith, which that verse then says, "Inna akramakum 'indallahi atqakum." Okay, it's not just something to say; it's something to do. And it is something that every one of us can try to move towards. And if we're focusing on that taqwa, if we're focusing on that iman, if we're focusing on doing everything for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, a lot of these differences just become non-issues. Why are we even discussing this in the first place? So that would be, start becoming the question. Okay? Why should we even be discussing some of these things, where you're from? Yeah, it's good to know where you're from, but does it really, you know, make a huge difference? Or is that the first question to ask? Or is the first question, or the first thing to say, salam alaikum, give a big hug to the same gender, and then, you know, then move on and discuss other things.
Since I mentioned it, I don't want to not fulfill, but I will try to be brief just to use some time then for yourself or for any other comments. The question I wanted to raise is that when we have identity, you know, we generally think of it in terms of ethnic and linguistic identity. These are things which are very visible for many of us in society at large. But since I want to be brief, I'll refer you to a book written by a scholar named Marshall Watson, The Venture of Islam. Some of you may be familiar with it, may have read it. He makes a general point about a difference between Islamic culture and European culture, especially in traditional societies. He says that, in general, Islamic society, because of Islamic values and the rules of Sharia, was gender segregated, but much less segregated by class. And he says that they're related. Because of a greater segregation of gender, men among themselves and women among themselves would interact across boundaries of class, across economic boundaries, and even perhaps ethnic boundaries, much more easily, because they were in a safe environment, socially speaking, and in terms of their values and so on. In Europe, it was the other way around. If there was a castle, the lady of the manor would be the hostess or the guests of the lord of the manor. But she would only interact with other people of the aristocratic class, men the same way. So there was a greater restriction of classes, but there was less of a restriction in terms of Sharia. You can refer to The Venture of Islam, which is in general a good book, and this is one of the points that the author, or the observations the author makes. The point that I wanted to encourage us to examine is that the rules that we have within Sharia and the values and the incidents that we have from the lives of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they sometimes have effects which might not always be visible to us. But there is a push that is being given in a certain direction. And one of the major pushes that we as Muslims are to try to understand and to maintain is that the integration that we have through our prayer, through our worship, through our Hajj, is to help us interact constructively with one another. and that is diametrically opposed to the nature of at least American society, at the very least, if not Western society. Broaden it to Western society as a whole. But we have wealthy neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. Wealthy neighborhoods have good public schools, poor neighborhoods do not. And so on and so forth. There is an opposite tendency within our society. Drawing inspiration from the totality of teachings that we have within Islam, the laws of fiqh, which sometimes some members of our community unfortunately view a little bit negatively. They view them as regressive, or they view them as something that is holding us back. Those same laws that superficially some of us might be somewhat less than generous towards, they often have many positive effects, which we don't appreciate. So that's something that I think if we had more time, we could spend some time discussing it now. But it's a general lesson that is certainly worthy of our thought and our consideration. What are the practices of Ahlul Bayt in terms of their interactions across class and other boundaries? What are some of the recommended acts and the obligations that we have within Sharia that create a certain impetus to maintain our identities as they have been given to us by our birth and circumstance and accidents of our existence, but that we can create an identity that pushes us in the direction of our beliefs and our values. That's something which I think is very rich and certainly worthy of study, contemplation, and greater thought.